Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Norma Ramos. She's a long-standing social justice attorney who self-defines as an eco-feminist. She links worldwide inequality of women to the destruction of the environment. She's received many awards in recognition of her work against human trafficking. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
So you're one of the many things you're known for is coming up with the phrase, prostitution is the world's oldest oppression. And can you say what you mean by that and just talk about that in general?
Well, we live in a world where in every city, in every town, in every country in the world, women and girls, women and children, actually increasingly boys too, but overwhelmingly women and girls, have been subjected to commercial sexual exploitation. And the word we know for that is also prostitution. And yet, we live in a world where this issue of prostitution has never been seriously taken up by progressive movements, not the liberals, actually, that end up defending it as sex work, and it is not sex work. And the left has completely ignored its responsibility to address this most worst abuse of women. And so over and over again, you've heard this phrase that it's the world's oldest profession. And in the 80s, I realized that actually this is the world's oldest oppression stemming from the world's oldest inequality, and that is of women.
And so what are you doing? Well, let's back up one step, because there is this I am pretty appalled by the way liberals, leftists, anarchists defend prostitution or define prostitution as work. And I just not very long ago, just a few days ago actually, saw some men who were responding to a very good article by Chris Hedges about how prostitution oppresses women. Some men were responding to this by saying, you know, why is he trying to limit women's choices? And talking about this in terms of attempts to any attempts to inhibit or limit in any way prostitution is presented by them as oppressing women. And two things about this. One of them is that I just find it extraordinary that any male could defend something that at the very least potentially harms women. That would be like a white person defending chattel slavery of African Americans or of Africans. And so there's that, and then there's also, it just seems so absurd to me. So can you just shoot down that notion, basically undercut what they're saying? Because that just seems so
yes.
crazy to me that I can't even respond to it.
Yes. It's actually, a lot of these men are being misled by liberal feminists who can often be found at very privileged elite women's colleges, and they have come up with a theory that prostitution is, in fact, agency is the term they've come up with it, that a woman actually finds liberation through her ability to sell her body. This is a very liberal notion that is devoid of any understanding that prostitution is actually a function of lack of choice, and that women of color, poor women, most especially indigenous women, children who have gone through the foster care system and graduate into homelessness. So homeless women are all overrepresented in prostitution. So when one begins to talk about something that results from a lack of choice, something that results from having one's opportunities and choices in the world being actually constrained and diminished to a point where you actually have no choice, then one has suspended their responsibility to bring some critical thinking to the issue. And that's why we actually are very grateful to Chris Hedges, because he's one of the few voices in the liberal left that is willing to step back and say, wait a minute here. I think we're talking about commercial sexual exploitation. I think we're talking about the destruction of women and girls. And one of the things that I tell people when I have these conversations about what is the nature of prostitution is that survivors have described prostitution as prepaid rape. And survivors have talked about prostitution as being an industry that is largely owned and controlled by organized crime. And so there is no liberation through organized crime. There is no liberation through commercial rape. There is only what has been documented by the Prostitution Research and Education NGO, headed by Melissa Farley. There is massive trauma.
So you use the word massive, and can you describe briefly the scale of either are you defining trafficking and prostitution the same, or are you defining them somewhat separately? I know that Rachel Morin describes them slightly differently. So I don't care about that. What I care about is the scale. Can you talk about the scale of either trafficking and or prostitution?
Well, it's an important question, actually. So we're going to go to that, because it's important to understand that there is a distinction between prostitution and trafficking, but it is a absolutely minor distinction. The vast majority of the way that prostitution unfolds actually meets the definition of human trafficking. So it's as people say, a distinction without a difference. They are fairly indistinguishable, except for that teeny tiny tiny percentage of women, and I do say tiny percentage of women, that may have taken a course with some of these teachers at a, you know, let's say Barnard College, who tells them that prostitution is women's liberation, and they may decide, oh, I'm going to decide to go and strip at a strip club and write a paper on it, you know. But those that choose to get into prostitution, by the way, can also choose to get out. Prostitution is actually very easy to get into and very difficult to get out of. I am on the board of Breaking Free, which is one of the most amazingly well-run and brilliantly conceived services for those who are trying very hard to exit prostitution, and they're located in Minnesota. And we have learned from women that it's very difficult to overcome all of the factors that led them into this horrific set of circumstances we know as prostitution. So prostitution is the end point of sex trafficking. So you cannot work against sex trafficking without working against prostitution. And that's what's important to know, so that if one wants to have an academic discussion about what's the difference between prostitution and sex trafficking, well, that is the end point of sex trafficking, is prostitution. And so that's what people need to keep in mind. And to also, I remember once being on a panel, and I looked over at this police sergeant, a retired police sergeant. He said something I've never forgotten. And he said in all his years, over 35 years of being on the police force, he never once came across a case of prostitution where there hadn't been some form of coercion. And in fact, that is the definition of the world's most agreed-to definition of human trafficking. The Palermo Protocol defines that sex trafficking includes the taking advantage of a position of vulnerability.
So can you, now that we've defined that, can you give a sense of the scale, both say in the United States and globally?
Well, you know, this is really something important to think about, because having done this work globally, I have seen different things. I've seen it play out differently around the globe. So first I'm going to start with the U.S. When I travel around the world, there's some people have this notion that the United States is such a wealthy country. And by the way, there are people in this country who have this misconception, that the United States is such a wealthy country, we certainly don't have such a serious problem with prostitution. But the truth is, the U.S. does. The U.S. has a very significant problem with prostitution and sex trafficking, and it has not been studied adequately. And people say to me, oh, but it's an illegal trade, it's an underground trade, and what I say to them is, what we need is the Department of Justice should undertake a study. And you know what? How I would do that study? I would simply survey every criminal court in this country and find out what the numbers are for women arrested for prostitution, because those are your sex trafficking victims. And then and that's not a difficult study to undertake. And then we would get a more realistic sense. But what we've learned about in this country is that the average age of entry into prostitution is 13 years old. What we also know about prostitution in the United States is that the large number of the prostituted came out of foster care. Did you want me to go on?
Well, aren't there also some really staggering statistics on the relationship between entry into prostitution and prior sexual abuse within either the origin home or the foster home?
Yes, there is an enormous, and that's true all over the world. So all over the world we find that. So all over the world, regardless of where we're talking now, whether it's the U.S. or anywhere else, we do find that those who end up in prostitution, who are vulnerable to prostitution, have 99% have experienced sexual abuse in childhood through a family member or through some community member abusing them. So we know that there are factors that render women and girls, women and children, vulnerable to prostitution, and they absolutely, at the top of the list, is previous sexual abuse. Poverty, people think, causes prostitution, but poverty does not cause prostitution. It simply exacerbates it. It makes it worse. The cause of prostitution is the inequality of women and girls.
Well, a couple things. We haven't really talked about the scale on a global scale yet. Like, how many women are we talking about worldwide? Are we talking women and girls and children? Are we talking about a total of 350? Are we talking about 17? Are we talking about 100,000? What numbers are we talking around the world?
We're talking about millions and millions, with some countries reporting higher levels than others. One of the things that increases prostitution is to legalize it. So in Germany, for instance, you have this industry of where that society has decided that they will make a place where there will be the creation of a class of human beings that will be available for commercial sexual use and abuse. Now, when you legalize prostitution, which is the worst possible thing you can do, you then get a ring of illegal prostitution that surrounds it, where you have women from developing countries that are trafficked into those countries. So where you have legalized prostitution, you're going to have more of it, and the scale we're talking is massive.
So there's one more question I want to ask before I switch to the next thing I would like to talk about in a moment is the role of demand, because so far we've been focusing on women, but I would like to switch it over to demand in a second. But there's one thing I want to ask first, which is another thing I hear a lot from the sort of sex work types in terms of, especially once again men saying this, is look, it's just a job. There's no difference between flipping burgers and working as a prostitute. I mean, I hate my job working at Walmart, so what are you to complain? That sort of thing. And how do you respond to that? Because that seems to me so fundamentally, I mean, basically all I can do when I hear that is get appalled, but I don't have the language. It's like, no, that's just not right, but I don't have the language. Can you give me the language to respond to that in the future?
Yes. I actually wrote something, Why Prostitution is Not Sex Work. The way to respond to that is that work confers dignity. And there is no dignity in having any man show up who is then going to buy the right to do anything he wants to do to the most personal parts of your body, the most private parts of your body. And we all know from listening to and reading, now there are quite a number of survivor memoirs out there, the most important book that has come along in 40 years on prostitution has been written by this brilliant, charismatic, principled survivor whose name is Rachel Moran, and she wrote a book titled Paid For. And if all you have to do is read that book to understand what men actually buy when they buy prostitution, they are not buying work. They are buying the right to act out a pornographic sexuality onto the bodies of vulnerable women and girls. And this is not work.
Well, thank you for that. Okay, so let's shift the focus now to what is the role of demand in fueling sex trafficking?
Well, this, of course, is where the solutions lie, because there would be no prostitution were it not for the demand for commercial sex. And so early on in working against commercial sexual exploitation, I had to decide whether I thought Johns, rapists, batterers, sexual abusers of children, whether these men were born that way or whether they were made. And I decided when I looked around in my own life and my brothers, the men in my life that I love, I know that men are not born this way. They are made this way. And so what is it that is taking our little boys that we give birth to, who we love and care for, and they grow up to be men that at one end of the scale do not respect women, deny them equal wages, maybe catcall on the street. What, and the other continuum, of course, is violence against women. What is the intervening factors here? And so there are a few things we need to look at. We have to look at privilege, male privilege. I've always believed that privilege corrupts, whether we're talking about white male privilege, whether we're talking about light-skinned privilege, any privilege.
Human supremacist privilege.
Any form of privilege, I believe, actually corrupts. It begins to create a culture of entitlement. It begins to create a sense of something or someone is less than who you are, because why would you then deserve better treatment if they were not less entitled? So I think we have to, this is the hardest thing, by the way, to have people look at is privilege, because we all have some form of it, and of course there's a scale of it. And as a light-skinned Puerto Rican woman, I recognize that as a light-skinned Puerto Rican woman, I have privilege over my darker-skinned sisters and brothers. And so I always like to start with myself, because we have to model what we say. And that's a painful thing to think about, because I don't want to feel that I'm privileged over anyone else. But I know that I am in connection to my darker-skinned brothers and sisters. And so it's very important for men who do social justice work, all men, white men, to understand that they have privilege, racial privilege, over all people of color and women, for men of color to understand that they have privilege over their women of color sisters. And so privilege is something we have to look at as a society, and we're beginning to see some dialogue take place around that over police killings. However, we have to look at sexuality, because prostitution becomes the place where men are destroying women and children through the very act that creates life. So why do we have this gift of human sexuality, this beautiful gift of human sexuality that is there for both pleasure, mostly pleasure, most sex is for pleasure, and then also procreation? And why has this become a vehicle to destroy women and girls? And I think you cannot get around the issue of the pornography industry. And Dr. Gail Dines, who wrote Pornland, which I urge all of your listeners to read, actually shows you that pornography is corrupting male sexuality, and it is moving it in the direction of encouraging men to buy commercial sex. And then when you listen to what women who have survived prostitution have to say, and I have spent a lot of time listening to and reading the memoirs of women who have survived this horrific, torturous abuse that is done to their bodies so that somebody else could have sexual pleasure. They all describe that the men are acting out pornographic sexuality on their bodies. And so the role of demand, so what are we going to do about this? Well, I believe that it is incredibly urgent for there to be a movement among men to dialogue, similar to the way the women's movement got started, to dialogue around among themselves what role has pornography played in shaping their own sexuality, so that men could take back their sexuality from the pornographers. And there's this wonderful TED Talk from a young man out of Israel. I think his name is Ron Garavelli. And I urge the men listening to listen to that TED Talk. And he talks about why he stopped viewing pornography. And begin to have those discussions and begin to form a movement to play a role in ending commercial sexual exploitation. Because without that, it's like having the civil rights movement without the participation of white people. White people played an incredibly important role in the civil rights movement when they decided that they began to analyze white skin privilege, and they were no longer going to stand by and allow people of color to be second-class citizens without them organizing with people of color and among themselves to bring forth major changes. And so that's what has to happen with all men. So men need to create that movement of beginning with a dialogue around how pornography has corrupted their sexuality.
You know, I interviewed Gail Dines a few weeks ago, and one of the things I mentioned in that interview, but I'll mention again, is that I didn't have a lot of history with porn. It was just never a part of my life, and it wasn't really a part of my friends' lives either. I don't know if I was in a lucky pocket or if times were different back then or what, but it just was never part of my life. And then I'm writing a book, Culture Make-Believe, back in 2000, 2001, and the book is about objectification and in general. And so I decided I had to do a chapter on pornography. So I started looking at porn, because if I'm gonna write about it, I've got to look at it. And so I looked at it, and for probably maybe 6 weeks or so, and there was this thing that happened that was like, okay, I have to completely quit doing this research and just go ahead and write the chapter because of how it affected me. I know there's a cliche of, you know, when men look at women, they disrobe them with their eyes. They take off their clothes and try to picture them naked. And that has not been part of my experience either. So I'm looking at porn for, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks, 6 weeks, not that long. And I'm walking to the library one day, and this woman's coming the other direction, and we meet eyes and just sort of nod and smile, and then she goes by. And here's the thing, is that my instantaneous thought was, what color is her pubic hair? And that was shocking to me, because that had never, like I said, it was not part of my experience to undress women. If I see some woman walking down the street and we nod and smile, you know, if I have any spontaneous fantasy at all, it might be like, wow, what would it be like to talk about environmentalism with her? You know, it's like, that's where my fantasies run. But it was shocking to me how something that I only took into my body for a month and a half, whatever, was able to affect something so intimate as my spontaneous fantasy life, the spontaneous fantasy life. And that just devastated me.
This is what has been said by the experts that are looking at the impact of pornography on viewers. And I can't remember the article, but I never forgot the central idea, which is that when we consume materials when we are sexually aroused, of course, pornography does sexually arouse people. There's something called brain imprinting, and it makes it's like these filters then release, and it goes and there, it's imprinted on your brain, and it does radically alter the way you think. This is what makes it so extremely dangerous that we have now generations of children who are never going to learn about sexuality through, for instance, in the pre-pornography generation, seeing lovers, you know, teenagers kiss and hold hands, or seeing, you know, the way sexuality plays out. And now it's the pornographers that are the sex education, and the pornography is just filled with hatred of women, filled with the erotization of violence, filled with the erotization of domination and subordination. And this is why we're beginning to see the effects with campus rapes. I mean, we're now having generations of young men who have grown up with horrific sexualized images of hurting women, and seeing women as mere objects that they can access regardless of whether a young woman wants to have sex with them or not.
So another thing that's very important to you, we're about at the a little over the halfway mark for this interview, and in our discussions beforehand, one of the things you made very clear is that you wanted to talk about trafficking in women, and you also wanted to make the linkages between that and this culture's assaults on the natural world. So can you, and one of the things you wrote to me in a note that you wanted to talk about is what men can do to create a world free of all violence against women and girls, and the urgency of ending abuse and exploitation of animals. So can you talk about, in your perspective, what is the relationship between, I mean, is it the entitlement? Is it the privilege? What is the relationship between the trafficking of women and the abuse of women and the abuse of the natural world?
Well, they're inextricably linked. This is why I call myself an eco-feminist. I believe the global inequality of women, which is the core original model of domination, that of men over women, has led to all other dominations. And that domination includes the domination of humans over our environment. I, by the way, never see human beings as separate from the environment. We come from the environment, we're part of it. And somewhere along the way, and I believe it's the creation of the inequality of women, somewhere along the way, we have, and you could probably do 5 shows on how Western thought and duality and mechanistic thinking comes out of all of this. But we have see ourselves as a species being separate and apart from nature, but we are nature. We are a part of nature, which means we're part of every living thing, every single tree, every single plant, every single animal. We are part of that, and we have a responsibility to treat all life with respect. And so this notion of it being separate is actually a myth. And I was just talking with you before the show about this report I read in the New York Times of I think it was seals or otters that were washing up along
sea lions
were washing up pups, were washing up along the California coast because they're hungry, they're starving, and their mothers have to swim further and further out to get fewer and fewer food to bring back. And I just have been so sad since I've read that article, because what is it going to take for us to wake up as a species that we do not have a right to occupy this world in a way that makes it inhospitable for all the other species? And I know that many of us have that consciousness. We know something is terribly wrong. We know that the way that we're living on this planet is terribly, something has gone so wrong. The oceans are filled with garbage. There's just, what are we going to do collectively as a species? And I think that we have got to understand that we have to start with ending all forms of violence, including violence against animals, all animals, both wild and domestic. And we can do that very simply by starting with not eating them, rejecting eating animals. We know that we can eat plant-based foods and be healthy. And if we just start there, there would be a major transformation on the planet. And there are many societies, by the way, that are fine and healthy that eat plant-based diets, such as Indian cuisine, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I actually take the problem a bit further back, that I think that, for what it's worth, I think the problem actually began with agriculture. And we can have discussions, and I actually interviewed somebody about this, that whether the oppression of women was the model for the oppression of non-humans, or whether the oppression of the non-human planet, which through agriculture was the model for the oppression of women. But there's actually something, a direction I would like to go with this, which is that it seems to me that what we're talking about when we talk about a perception of separateness or privilege is really what we're talking about is a war against all reality. Because when you perceive males as superior to females or humans as superior to trees or insects or orangutans, doesn't matter, what you're doing is you're really declaring a war against reality itself. And that's a war that you can destroy reality, but you can't win the war.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Yes, but I think we're living in a world now where people need very concrete things to do. And so what I ask people to do, and some people say, well, I just can't stop eating meat. And what I say to them is, then only buy free range and reduce it to just keep cutting back and back and back. Do whatever you can where you are to end cruelty and exploitation of animals. There's a wonderful publication I give money to, and it's called 101 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian. That's a wonderful group to support. And support the groups that are working to envision another way of living that does not visit pain and cruelty on other creatures.
Well, this is one place that you and I are going to have to end up disagreeing, because actually plant-based agriculture kills, if somebody's eating a plate of rice, they've killed at least as many creatures as someone who eats meat. It's growing rice. There are salmon who die because they take water for rice for the Central Valley. And so if you look at the larger linkages, it ends up being, I mean, I completely agree with you about factory farms, but we should probably just leave that and move on.
No, that's an important thing to think about. We just have to find out then, how do we eat that doesn't visit destruction? It's okay to disagree. I actually need to learn more about what you just said. So we would just have to know, what is that model? How can we eat in a way that does not visit destruction? I want to know how to do that. So please, you should do a whole show on that.
Well, I have. And the thing that's really difficult, and one of the things we need to come to terms with, is not you and I, but all of us, is the fact that right now there is no way for humans to live sustainably on the planet because we've exceeded carrying capacity. And sure, we can reduce, and I completely agree with you. You know, factory farms are an abomination, and we should never support them in any possible way. And the question becomes, how do you enfold yourself into what the local community can support? And there's what we have a real problem, because you're right now living in New York City, and there's no way that New York City can exist without massive violence to the natural world. And then I'm living in Crescent City, California, where the population is about 8,000, where it probably could have supported this, but the problem is that the runs of salmon, which is what the Talua ate for 12,000 years here, the runs of salmon have been completely hammered. And so even Crescent City, with its tiny little population, even that's no longer sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up being, we're in, this culture has painted us into a very bad corner. So let's back up for a second. And what is, could you define ecofeminism? What is that? And how is that going to be helpful to women, to men, to humans, to non-humans? Why is ecofeminism important? I've interviewed women who are definitely ecofeminists, but I've never asked anybody what is ecofeminism?
Well, ecofeminism is premised on the understanding that the original domination is that of men dominating women, and that became the core model of all other dominations, the old dominating the young, racial domination, and then humans dominating nature and dominating animals. So it has to do with understanding that the core domination, model domination, is that of men over women, and that became, out of that flowed this dominator model that has led to the destruction. So the destruction of women leads to the destruction of the environment. And so to correct everything, the only way we stand a chance of getting ourselves as a species is to create equality for women. And the way we do that is we end how inequality of women is enforced, maintained and enforced, which is through violence.
Which is one reason that a lot of women say that you can't really be an anti-war activist without being a feminist.
Yes.
So what are... We talked about privilege. I mean, here's the thing. Okay, so in my first book, A Language Older Than Words, my first big book, one of the things I talk about is a question I was asking as a little child. My father's extremely violent. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. He broke my sister's arm. My brother had epilepsy from blows to the head. And a question I was asking as a child is, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And in many ways, 26 books later, however many books later, that's still a question I'm asking about the larger scale, is this is all just nuts. And how do you... And I don't know if I'm asking you this professionally or personally or if there's a difference, but how do you explain this or understand this insanity of, I mean, you talked about the words privilege, entitlement. I completely agree with all those. Those absolutely. But nonetheless, when we're talking about these levels of sadism, that just falls apart. You know, there's something beyond that, or do you disagree? I mean, I don't know. I'm still 26 books later. I'm still grappling with the question of why the atrocities.
You know, it's something that a lot of us spend time thinking about. I think I've come up with some answers, and I think it comes down to this: because they can. Because we live in societies are here to. We have societies so that we can collectively act and ideally collectively act for the well-being of all the members of society. And so society sets rules. And when women and girls, women and children are devalued through domination, through what we have been talking about, through the privileging of men over and boys over women and girls, when you have that privileging, when you have that core basic inequality, when you have that as the overarching defining element of a society, you're going to have the violence. And so because they can, and there have, when you devalue something, when you, there, and then there's a whole culture moving men in that direction, which is getting more and more vicious by those who study what's happening. I mean, the pornography industry cannot be undervalued here. It is an enormous industry that billions and billions and billions of dollars a year flooding our world, flooding almost, I don't know one culture that hasn't been touched by it, with the most horrific images and video games that are incredibly pornographically influenced. Grand Theft Auto, you know, shoot prostituted women, you get points. So because they can, they have a culture that tells them they can and encourages them that they can, and the consequences for when they do visit violence against women and children, the consequences are almost inconsequential without there being movements, the women's movement, beginning to work harder and harder to hold men accountable. This is why men have an incredibly important role, because this privileging, as I say, of men over women and girls, this has got to stop, and men have an urgent role to play in ending it.
So if part of...
Thank you for what you've done.
Oh,
you've
thanks.
Played an enormous role, your writings, your leadership. Thank you so much for the leadership that you have demonstrated on this issue.
Oh, well... Thanks for saying that, and I really appreciate it. And at the same time, I just think, how could I do any other? I mean, it just I guess my mom raised me right, you know, that if one sees an injustice, then one attempts to right it. I mean, isn't that just what one does?
You know, yes, but I want to say something else about ecofeminism. You know, many people, when I love talking at college campuses, because the young people know this, there's a powerful shift going on, and all of us know this in our hearts. There is this imbalance, this global universal inequality of women and girls to men and boys, this has created a energy imbalance on the planet. And a lot of people didn't understand what 2012 was about, but the last page of the Mayan calendar is the man holding the power scepter to the female. And so the most important thing we need to do is to rebalance that energy, the male energy to the female energy, by, in other words, fighting for that equality. And again, inequality is achieved and maintained through violence. So everything that we can do to end all forms of violence, including with animals, of course, is going to create that world. And you've done that. Certainly your career and your advocacy has been about that. And so we need to just keep sending that message out. Men and boys need to take a stand against violence against women and girls, and it's going to be all about ending violence, which is how we begin to rebalance the planet's energy, so there will be global equality between our species. You know, we're the only species on the planet. No other species does this. Men are destroying women and girls through sex.
Well, that's kind of a bad idea.
It's the only species that is doing that.
There's two directions I want to go right now. One of them is that you're talking about men doing the right things. Also mentioned speaking at universities. And I want to tell you quickly about a story I have from this one student who brought me to the University of Michigan, actually, several years ago. And he did a pretty cool thing, which is that he was living someplace, and he told his roommates that he was going to have to move out because they stopped refusing, I mean, they refused to stop calling women bitches and cunts in his presence. And he said, look, if you're going to use that language, I need to move out. And I thought that that was, it's a very small thing, but I thought that that stand in solidarity was, it really impressed me and seems to me one step that we need to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a courageous act, and then the next step should have been organizing.
Yeah, that's very true.
You know, just remove it. It's like he's hearing them calling African-American or Latino students a racial pejorative. Would it have been enough just to move out? No.
Well, that's a great...
You got to organize.
That's a great point. I just have to say he was also very young, so he was smarter than I was at his age. But you make a fabulous... and desperately important point. And that actually leads to the second thing I wanted to talk about. If part of the problem, or if part of the core of the problem is because they can, then how do we make it so they can't? How do we, this is really a sort of a transition to what do we do collectively and individually?
Well, the number one thing that needs to be done has never happened in the world on any significant scale. And here it is. For the first time in the history of human beings, men have to make it their political priority to create equality for women and girls. And that's the answer right there. That becomes the number one political priority of all men. That they'll put everything else aside for just this until we get this right. And there are concrete goals that can be met. There are concrete things that could happen. Women have to be at least 50% of all legislatures and heads of state. There has to be equality across the world. The wage gap gets closed. There will be no tolerance for any form of violence against women. Commercial sexual exploitation will be ended immediately. There will be serious consequences. Look what the Nordic countries have done. And they lead the world on all indicators of achieving violence against women. It began in Sweden in 1999. That country decided when the Soviet Union collapsed and they were overrun with sex trafficking, they said, what are we going to do? And they did something very few governments do. They said, you know what? We're going to consult with the human rights and women's rights activists within our own borders and ask them for advice. And what they came up with, which is now known as the Nordic model. And they decided, okay, based on the advice they were given by the people who had worked on this issue in Sweden for decades, they decided, oh my gosh, we've been arresting the wrong people. We've been arresting the victims. We will now send a message to men that women and girls are not for sale. We will not tolerate the prostitution of other human beings, and we will arrest the men and boys. And most importantly, we will give women and girls an exit strategy, because prostitution is actually very easy to get into and very hard, as I said earlier, to get out of. They need social services, a full range. They need employment opportunities, and they need, most of all, housing. So that is what needs to be done. We stop, I say, you know, medical terms, stop the bleeding. Start with the worst abuses of women, which is all forms of violence against women, including prostitution, and then work your way back, end the wage gap, severe consequences for any acts of violence. And when I say severe, meaning you're going to jail. You're not just going to get a fine. You're going to go to jail if you would, you know, put crimes against people, make that the priority, as opposed to crimes against property. Send the message out that women and children will be safe. That the right to personal safety is a core human right.
That does not seem like an unreasonable concept at all, does it?
No, it's a very basic one, isn't it?
So one of the ways I like to end the interviews a lot of times is to ask about sort of policy. So by which I ask, so if they made you the queen of all things having to do with the exploitation of women, what would you, it sounds like you've given a policy. Is there anything else that you would do if you suddenly could implement any policies you wanted having to do with what we've talked about? Is there anything else you'd do?
The first thing I would do is that every single child in the world would be safe. They would be able to move through their childhood free of any form of abuse or exploitation, and that would include all human beings, women and men. And the second thing I would do is there would be no such thing as poverty. No human being would know what it was to not have meaningful work, housing, a safe, clean, green environment, and of course, I would end all cruelty and exploitation of animals.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Norma Ramos. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.